Welcome to OU.org and www.etshalom.com. My name is Yitzhak Etshalom, and we are studying the book of Shmuel. Today we're going to study the fourth chapter of Shmuel Bet. And if you recall, at the end of the previous chapter, Avner, who had switched sides and come to make a treaty with David, was killed by his opposite number, Yoav. And now back in Mahanaim, on the other side of the Jordan, Eshbaal gets the news of this. Vayishma ben Shaul ki met Avner b'Chevron. He heard that Avner died. Vayipuy adav, his hands were weak. In other words, he felt no support, no strength. V'chol Yisrael nivhalu, and all of Yisrael. Now, of course, this is not exactly the case. Kol Yisrael, it means all of Yisrael who were aligned with him, were shook. U'shnei anashim sarei gedudim hayu ben Shaul. There were two men of the army who were with Shaul's son at the time. Shem Hachad Ba'ana and Shem Hasheni Rechav. Those are their names. Bnei Rimon HaBe'erotis from Be'erot, which, if you recall, from Yoshua Perek Tet, is one of the cities of Binyamin. Bnei Binyamin, Kigam Be'erot Techasher al Binyamin. Now the text reminds us that Be'erot is considered part of Binyamin's territory. And these two senior officers in the army, as it were, of Eshbaal, are named Rechavu Ba'ana. Vayivrechu ha-Be'erotim gitayma, and the people of Be'erot fled, after Avner died. Vayusham garim ari amazeh, and evidently by the time Sefer Shmuel is edited, these exiles from Be'erot are living in, evidently in Gitayim. It is not Gat. They did not flee to God, but they fled to another city. In the meantime, we have a parenthetic note, which is very misleading at this point, about a remnant of Shaul's family. The Yonatan ben Shaul ben Nechera Glaim. He had a son who was lame. Now, we never heard of Yonatan getting married, but that's of no consequence, because the Tanakh will not give us information like that, unless it's germane to the story. Ben Chamesh Shanim Haya Bevo Shmuat Shaul V'Yonatan Mi'Yisrael. This kid was 5 years old when the news came that his grandfather and father had died in Israel. Vatisaehu Omanto, and so his nursemaid was carrying him. Vatanos, and she fled. Vahiv Chovzalanus, as she was hurrying to flee, be out of fear that her master had died, and she was afraid of reprisal. He fell, and he was lamed. Evidently, he fell quite sharply, and became lame, and he is lame from here on. And his name is Mephibosheth. Again, like Yeshboshet, we find out later on in Divrei Hayamim that his name is Mephibaal. But again, the name Baal is substituted in Sefer Shmuel with something about shame, Boshet or Beshet. In the meantime, that parenthetic note is helpful, because when Ish-Boshet, who we assume to be the last remaining member of Shaul's family, will soon be killed, we are concerned, or we should be concerned, that David's oath to Shaul that he would not wipe out his family would be partially violated. Indeed, David did not kill any of these people, but David would not have protected them properly, and perhaps David would feel that way. But now we find out that Yonatan has a son who is still alive, and therefore the death of Eshbaal will not be the end of Shaul's line. This may also augur for what will happen much later in Shmuel Bet, when there is a rebellion against David, and there will be a rebuilding of sentiment in favor of Shaul's line, because there is somebody in Shaul's line around whom to build that sentiment. In the meantime, these two fellows, Rechav Va'ana, they came by Avol Kachom Hayom Beit Ish Boshet. They came into Eshbaal's house. He was taking the afternoon nap. He's napping in the afternoon. The simple read of this text is that they came into the house disguised as people who were selling wheat. And they stabbed him through his chest. Again, like we had with Avner and earlier with Asael. And these two brothers fled. They came into to Eshbaal's bedroom and his chambers, and they assassinated him, and then they ran away. And now there's a rewriting of this to explain what they did. They came into the house, and he was lying on his bed, b'chadar mishkavo. V'yakuhu v'yimituhu. They killed him. V'yasirut rosho. They took off his head, which takes us back, of course, to Shaul's death, and now his son dies in the same way, but from a different perspective, from a different side. It's his own men who kill him. Vaykhud roshova achud derech harava kol alayla. And they took his head and they walked all night. And this reminds us of the people of Yavesh who were doing the opposite. They were sparing Shaul from humiliation. Here Shaul's son is killed and his assassins take his head and they walk through the Arava all night, to go south, which means they walked on the Jordanian side, evidently, and then they crossed over. They came to Hebron and they brought the head of Ishbosheth, and this is now the second time, and perhaps even the third time, that somebody comes to David presenting him with information that someone has died, certainly the second time, where the messenger would assume that David would rejoice, and he is chagrined to find that David's response is anything but what he had expected. And here we find it explicitly. These fellows come, and they bring the head of Ishbosheth, and they said as follows, Vamru'al Melach, Hinei Rosh Ish Boshet Ben Shaul Oyivcha, Asher Bikesh Nafshecha. Now, the modifier is a little unclear here. He said, here is the head of Ish Boshet, the son of Shaul, your enemy. Meaning, Ish Boshet your enemy, or Shaul's your enemy. Asher Bikesh Nafshecha seems to be pointing to Shaul. He wanted to kill you, but then again, Ish Boshet also was at war with David. In any case, Vayitena Adonai Laduni HaMelech Nekamot HaYom HaZeh MiShaul UMiZaro. And now God has given you vengeance from Shaul and from his seed. So in other words, Ish-bosheth is not presented here as an enemy king or the leader of an enemy group, but rather as the last vestige of Shaul's line, and these fellows consider themselves, in a self-congratulatory way, to be the vehicle for God's vengeance on behalf of David against his enemies and the family of his enemies. And this plays into the usual approach that would be taken whenever there was a new dynasty or a new family taking over, that there would be an attempt to have an ouster of the older family, and a pretty total massacre of anyone who was part of that family. Witness the streets of Paris in 1789. Vayan David Rechav et Bana Achiv Bnei Rimon HaBeiroti, and we get their full names, and David responded to them, again with surprise, Vayomer Lehem, Chai Adonai Shepadat Nafshi Mikol Tzara, I thank God who saved me from all troubles. And David, and here seems to be pointing to the problem in their attitude, and of course to their actions. He said, God saved me from the trouble. I don't need you. God saved me. God has protected me. I don't need you to go and do a criminal act in order, and we'll see that David calls it a criminal act in order to help me out. The fellow who came and told me that Amalekik said the Shaul has died, he thought himself to be a bringer of glad tidings. We will see that word come up again towards the end of Shmuel Bet in a very tragic circumstance. I grabbed him, I killed him at Siklag. I killed him for the news that he gave me. It was, he thought he was such a, on my good side and good terms with me, because he brought me news that he thought would cheer me. I took him and I killed him. Now David is shading here a little bit, because he did not kill the fellow for telling him Shaul was dead. He killed the fellow for claiming to be the one who killed Shaul. And that's what he says to him. And then he applies the same to these people. We have to talk about the word tzaddik here for a moment. Anashim rishaim, he's referring to these two fellows, these wicked fellows, killed a tzaddik beveto al mishkavo, in his house, on his bed. And the fact that it is in his bed should be irrelevant. We'll see why it is relevant. So now I will seek out his blood from you, meaning I'm going to exact justice for you for the wrongful killing of this tzaddik, and clear out the evil from the land. Now, what is the use of the term tzaddik, and indeed the use of the term rasha here in this context? It's important to note, and we've talked about this in several other contexts over the course of these lectures, that the language of the Tanakh is not necessarily the language. First of all, it's not a static language. It's not a language that remains the same in its usage early on in Tanakh and later on in Tanakh. Grammatic forms change. As an example, when Sarah is taken to Paro's house, it says Vatukach in the Pual. When Esther, 1,000+ years later, is taken to Achashverosh's palace, it's Vatilakach in the Nephal. There are different grammatic forms that are used. There are different words that are used. As the language progresses, the text itself, we saw back in Shmuel Aleph Perek Tet, they used to call a Navi a Roeh, and then they called him a Navi. The word Sadiq, but certainly between Tanakh and rabbinic usage, and by the way, between rabbinic usage and medieval usage, and between medieval usage and the late medieval usage and modern usage, and between modern usage and contemporary usage, terms have changed. A classic example of this, is one of which many people are ignorant, and that is the use of the word Am Haaretz. Am Haaretz is a phrase is conventionally used today to refer to someone who is ignorant. And there are even nouns associated with Amaratziskeit, Amaratzis, right, which is certainly not a Hebrew form, but to be ignorant or to display ignorance is to display Amharatzut, as people might say. But an Am Haaretz in Tanakh is actually almost the opposite. It's an important citizen. It's a landowner. Take a look in Bereshit Chaf Gimel. When Avram is negotiating with the citizens of Hebron, he bows before Am Haaretz Bnei Chet, the owners of the land. And throughout Tanakh, that's the meaning of the word. In early rabbinic times, Am Haaretz refers to somebody who is not scrupulous either about mitzvot in general or about mitzvot, particular mitzvot. Witness the sugyan brachot, the sugyan sota, about how we define an Am Haaretz. Is it somebody who doesn't wear tzitzit on his clothes, doesn't wear tefillin, doesn't raise his children to learn Torah, etc.? And then there is the other grouping of Am Haaretz, which has to do specifically with scrupulousness and care with regards to mitzvot tatliyot ba'aretz, whether or not they separate truma and maaser, thus leading to the entire institution of demai. When you buy fruit or when you buy produce from an Am Haaretz, the parts you have to separate because of the suspicion that they did not properly separate. There are all sorts of other applications of Am Haaretz, and of course, with time, and specifically in the modern era, Am Haaretz came to mean somebody who was fully ignorant. And the same thing has happened to the word tzaddik. Tzaddik in modern Hebrew is somebody who is righteous. Tzaddik, by the way, a couple hundred years ago was also a title that is rarely used anymore. For the head of a Hasidic court, what we call an admur, a rebbe, was called a tzaddik. In the earlier periods of the 19th century and the late 18th century in the world of Hasidut. The word tzaddik in rabbinic language generally means somebody who is a mitzvah observant Jew, somebody who is righteous and therefore perhaps has more merits than faults. But the word tzaddik in Tanakh, when referring to a person, means none of that. It means innocent. And the classic example of that, we'll see one right now, but the classic example of that is in Dvarim, in Parsha Ki Tetzé, when the text refers to coming to court and says that people will present their claims and the Beit Din will make its judgment, Virshiu et harasha v'itztiku et hatzadik. They will find the innocent one innocent, itztiku et hatzadik, and they will find the guilty one guilty. And both of those words, both of those usages, are the ones that are being used here. Parenthetically in Bereshit, the same is true. When Hashem describes Noach as an ish tzaddik, the point of it being that he is innocent and therefore should not suffer the punishment that all of the guilty people who end up in the flood will suffer. If you take a look at Avraham's negotiations for the city of Sodom, suddenly it all makes sense. Avraham is saying perhaps there are 50 people who are innocent in this city. Can you destroy the city and take these innocent people with the guilty? The innocent should be the same as the guilty. So therefore, what is David saying to these two men? David is saying, you are guilty people because you went and killed an innocent man on his bed. And that's why the mention of the bed is important. Because killing somebody while he is lying on his bed is certainly taking advantage of somebody who is vulnerable, and it's an act of wickedness. If the man is culpable, bring him to court. If he is not culpable, if it's a war, well, you don't fight a war by attacking somebody when he's in his bed. And you are his own soldiers. So therefore, you are Rishayim, and he was an innocent person, and you will die for spilling innocent blood. So David commanded the boys to kill him, just as he commanded the boys around him to kill the Amaleki, who brought the news about Shaul. They cut off their limbs, their fingers and their hands and feet, and hung them over the Brecha in Hebron, evidently as a sign that David does not want people to go and take care of these killings for him. But Rosh Ishboshet Lakhuva Ikbru B'Kever Avner B'Hebron, and they took his head and they buried it with, and they took Ishboshet's head, sorry, and they buried it with in Avner's grave in Hebron. So Ishboshet was laid to rest with Avner, both of them in Hebron, far away from Binyamin territory, but perhaps demonstrating that David did not have personal animus to either of them and was not pleased at all with the death of either of them. In any case, we've completed the study of Perek Daled, and we are excitedly preparing ourselves tomorrow to see the conquest of our eternal capital as it first comes into Jewish hands, from to where it shall, Emir Tz Hashem, remain forever. Everyone should have a wonderful day.